We have recorded the statements of some of your most learned men that no human being or other higher form of life, as we know it, could endure, or even survive accelerations of this order of magnitude. This has been one of the causes of disappointment to us in our evaluation of the level of intelligence of the people of Earth. It seems to us that even a moderately intelligent layman, with the average knowledge which your people possess, should be able to refute this statement at once. The answer is simply that the force which we use to accelerate our vehicles is identical in nature to a gravitational field. It acts not only upon every atom of the vehicle, but equally upon every atom of mass that is within it, including the mass of the pilot and any passengers. Regardless of the intensity of the field, therefore, every particle of mass within the influence of the field is in a uniform state of acceleration, or, as you would term it, free fall, with respect to the field. Under these circumstances, acceleration has no effect upon the vehicle or upon anything within it, and, as you have just experienced, cannot even be felt by the passenger. But in that case, I thought, why am I not floating around in the air as things are supposed to do in a missile that is in free fall? The answer to this should also be fairly obvious, was the reply. Before the ship's own field was generated, it was resting upon the earth, and you were resting upon the seat. There was a force of one gravity acting between your body and the seat. Since the force which accelerates both the ship and your body acts in exact proportion to the mass, and since the Earth's gravity continues to act upon both, the original force between your body and the seat will remain constant, except that it will decrease as the force of gravity of the planet decreases with distance. When traveling between planetary or stellar bodies far from any natural gravity source, we find it necessary, for practical reasons, to reproduce this force artificially. The gravity to which we are accustomed is but little more than one half that of Earth. It is one of the reasons that it will require so much time for one of us to become completely acclimated to your environment. If I were to land now upon your planet, I could tolerate the doubled gravitational force for a time, but the double weight of all my internal organs would cause them to be displaced downward, seriously hampering their functions. The difference in blood pressure between head and feet when standing erect would be double that to which we are accustomed, and there would be several other complications. This is not merely theory or calculation, it has been learned by experience in the past. If, on the other hand, I remain in my own ship, the gravitational force to which I am subject can be increased by small but regular increments. The supporting tissues will gradually increase in size and strength until, eventually, your gravity will become as normal to me as my own is now. When this time comes, and if the immediate problems of survival for your race can be solved, it is our hope that you, together with a few others who may be willing to join us, will be able to assist us in bridging the considerable gulf which exists between our culture and yours. As I explained before, we will never attempt to thrust either our knowledge or our culture upon your people, and will not even offer it unless there is substantial evidence that they desire it, and that it would be advantageous to them. There is certainly no such evidence at the present time. It is also true that the purpose of this visit is not entirely philanthropic, since there are some materials upon your planet which we could use to the advantage of both our peoples, materials which you have in great abundance but which are rather scarce elsewhere in this solar system. While the use of some of these materials would be of assistance to us, our services to your people will not be made contingent upon such use. Any knowledge or aid which we can give will be freely offered. Could you explain to me the principles of operation of this craft? I asked. How do you produce the tremendous amount of energy necessary to accelerate a ship like this to such high velocities? And how do you apply that energy without producing any outward evidence of its application? Before I could give any explanation that would be truly understandable, was the reply, I would first have to extend your knowledge considerably in the area which you refer to as physics. There are several concepts and a number of words that are necessary to explain the propulsion system, which do not yet exist in your vocabulary or your consciousness. Perhaps I can make my meaning clearer by a simple analogy. A man seeking scientific knowledge is somewhat like an ant climbing a tree. He knows when he is moving upward, but but his vision is too limited to encompass the entire trunk. The result is that he is likely to find himself climbing one of the limbs, without realizing that he has left the main trunk. All goes well for a time. He can still climb upward and even pluck some of the fruits of his progress, but eventually he begins to become confused as the solid branch begins to break up into myriad of twigs and leaves all pointing in different directions. So the seeker of knowledge, if he is on a limb, finds that the great basic laws which have always seemed so unshakable, now begin to divide and to point in different directions. The scientist comes to the conclusion that he is nearing the limit of the knowledge that can be grasped and understood by the mind, and that all physical laws ultimately become purely statistical. When he has reached this point, he can make further progress only by following a line of abstract reasoning employing mathematical symbols, many of which represent quantities which have no actual existence, and so cannot be pictured or followed by the mind. Such a process is like traveling on one of your subways. If you take the proper train, you will probably arrive at the destination you had in mind. But since you cannot see where you are going or how you got there, it is always possible that there was a shorter, simpler and easier way to get to the same place. The fundamental truths are always simple and understandable when viewed from the proper perspective. So the branch becomes simple and understandable as a branch when viewed from above, on the main trunk. Unfortunately, your science is still attempting to make one lower limb take the place of the entire tree of knowledge. However, there will be time enough for further discussions of physics later. Since this test flight is principally a sightseeing tour, I should, as the host, be pointing out the sights to you. Next headline, the original civilization. The large city to the north of you is St. Louis, and the glow on the horizon dead ahead is Cincinnati. You will be over it in less than 2 minutes, and soon after you will be able to see the lights of Pittsburgh. You can see that we have learned a great deal of your geography as well as your language. Your history is not quite so well known to us, since your race does not think much in terms of the past, and so our knowledge of it comes primarily from random and intermittent observations. Of course, the history of the original civilizations of this planet are known to us, much better and more completely than they are known to your race. This last statement did not fully register on my consciousness at the time, as I was engrossed in watching the lights of Cincinnati swimming silently toward me, on the Earth's surface 35 miles below. Because of our eastward travel, I knew that the moon must now be almost directly overhead, but the Earth gave little evidence of its reflected light. The greenish phosphorescence I had seen when rising in New Mexico had almost disappeared. I speculated briefly upon the probable albedo of the Earth, but then realized that it was only moonlight that I was judging by, and in any event, I was not nearly far enough from the Earth to form any valid estimate of the albedo. The lights or Cincinnati were almost directly beneath me now. There were too many lights, and they were too close together to distinguish many of them individually. The general effect was that of looking down upon a bonfire which had burned down to a bed of bright coals, with a few much brighter points which flashed and sparkled like rhinestones in a spotlight. Of course, Cincinnati was not the only city visible from this point. At an altitude of 35 miles, the line of sight becomes very long, and even in the restricted area of the viewing screen, I could see literally hundreds of various sized embers, sparkles and pinpoints of light, all representing cities, towns, industries or guiding beacons. "You will be over New York City in a few minutes," the voice said. "I am about to bring the level of the sampling device down to about 20 miles. Since the craft in which you are riding was not designed especially to carry passengers, the passenger compartment being only an emergency provision, it was not considered necessary to incorporate complete negative gravity compensation, such as we have in all of our larger ships. Consequently, as you start downward, you will be accelerating in the direction of your own gravity so that your body weight will become somewhat less. If this becomes distressing to you, I will lower the rate of acceleration." I felt a mild lifting of my stomach, such as one feels when starting down in a rather slow elevator, except that the sensation persisted for about 30 seconds. Then my weight seemed to become normal again. You are now moving downward at a constant rate which will bring you to the proper level in another minute. The leveling off process, of course, involves positive gravity acceleration which is compensated so that you will not feel it. You did not seem to be disturbed by the change in gravity, but since your race has not yet developed gravity compensation devices for your transportation vehicles, I suppose that you may be more accustomed to such changes than we. If you think that I should be distressed by a change as mild as that, I replied, you should try riding on one of our roller coasters or doing an outside loop in one of our squirt jobs. Just a moment, came the reply, I am afraid that you have me at a disadvantage. I had flattered myself that my command of your language, or at least its vocabulary, was practically complete. Yet, in a single sentence, you have used two terms whose meaning is unknown to me. Would you please explain them or at least give me synonyms? You mean roller coaster and squirt job? I asked. The roller coaster is a mechanical device found in many of our amusement parks. It consists of a low open car with seats for passengers, and stout handrails for them to grip. It has steel wheels which roll upon a pair of steel tracks laid upon an elevated framework. When the passengers have taken their seats, the car is connected to a moving chain between the tracks, which tows the car to the highest point in the structure. There the car is released from the chain, and gravity is allowed to take over. The tracks dip downward at a very steep angle, until they reach the ground level and then again rise sharply, almost to the level of the starting point. These sudden climbs and drops are repeated a number of times, and there are several steeply banked turns of short radius, so that the track is actually continuous, and at the conclusion of the ride the passengers have been returned to the starting point, and the car is ready for another load of thrill-seekers. The feeling of exhilaration produced by the ride is caused by the fact that the reflex portion of the brain, upon sensing the rapid change of gravity, causes adrenaline to be released into the bloodstream. This occurs, of course, whenever the body is confronted by sudden peril, but in this case, the rider knows there is no real danger, and is able to enjoy the stimulation produced by the adrenaline without being subject to any actual hazard. A squirt job is a term in American slang referring to one of our jet-propelled aircraft. I presume you are fully familiar with these, since you should have had ample opportunity to study them. An outside loop is a maneuver in which the aircraft describes a circle in a vertical plane, during which the upper side of the plane remains at the outer periphery of the circle. Thank you, replied my host. I am now sure that we made no mistake in choosing you as a means of direct contact. You are now at the 20-mile level, and your city of New York lies before you. The craft is approaching it from the northwest side, and will continue on this course until it reaches the ocean at the northeast extremity of the city. Your velocity has been reduced to about 600 miles per hour so that you will have more time to enjoy the view. The craft will circle the city until it is traveling westward along the southern extremity. At the same time, the craft will rotate slowly so that the viewing screen will always be pointed toward the center of the city so that you will be able to see every portion of it before the return trip is begun. If I were a writer or a poet, I might, perhaps, do some small justice to the sight that met my eyes as the greatest metropolis in the world rotated slowly before me. Since I am neither a poet nor a writer, but only a technician, with limited vocabulary for aesthetic expression, it seems almost hopeless even to make the attempt. At the 20-mile level the lights were much brighter and had greater individuality. This was no glowing bed of coals with a few brighter sparks. This was a vast array of millions of blue-white diamonds, scintillating and coruscating against a black velvet background. The differing temperatures of the various air strata beneath me, combined with the rapid motion of the ship, caused the lights to twinkle violently, so that the entire city was a sea of pulsing, shimmering luminescence. If I were an artist, I thought, this would probably be the greatest moment of my life, but it seems that my need for knowledge must outweigh my appreciation of purely aesthetic values. Beautiful as this scene is, and interesting as the ride has been, I would gladly have traded it all for a 5-minute tour of the mothership. Although I had not expressed my thoughts aloud, they were immediately answered. We regret that there was not enough time to arrange such a tour, but you will remember that we are not yet adapted to your atmosphere, nor are you adapted to ours. If there had been more time, we could have prepared a suit such as your people wear when they go beneath the surface of the sea. This would have enabled you to come into our ship without changing either your atmosphere or ours. But even then the tour would have been awkward and cumbersome, and not very enlightening to you. While we are not nearly as enslaved by time as your race appears to be, nevertheless, in maintaining a fixed position above your planet while not in orbit, we are drawing heavily upon our energy resources and, even as men of your race who sail the sea, we sometimes find it necessary to sail with the tide. If you will agree to assist us when the time comes, we will have completed our task here for the time being, and will be leaving your planet shortly, in order to replenish our energy supply. This can best be done by dropping in close to your sun, and making one or two close orbits, through the outer portion of its corona. Our ship, like all interstellar vehicles, is equipped with a completely enveloping field mechanism. One of the functions of this field is to absorb all forms of electromagnetic radiation, from radiant heat to cosmic rays, and to convert their energy to a stable form suitable for storage and later use. Thus our ships can collect small amounts of useful energy, even while traveling in interstellar space, although the amount is seldom sufficient to balance even the biological requirements of the passengers. Occasionally, therefore, after a deep space journey, it becomes desirable to bring the ship into close proximity to the nearest star, so that the energy banks may be fully charged. The rate at which the field can absorb and convert energy is almost unlimited, so that no amount of heat or other forms of radiation reaching the ship will have any measurable effect upon it or its passengers. Some of our faster patrol ships, while in compound acceleration for an interstellar flight, have passed through small portions of a star's photosphere, without damage or severe discomfort. During such passages, energy equal to several millions of your kilowatt-hours is converted and stored during each second of exposure. In the ship's conversion chambers, the energy first takes the form of exceedingly dense plasma contained within very strong fields, and finally becomes a form of matter which is reasonably stable, but readily reconvertible to useful energy. The momentum we acquire in falling toward your sun will be used to balance the sun's gravity as our ship circles in a partial orbit, and finally, in what you would describe as a slingshot effect, the ship will be hurled by its own momentum back in the direction from which it came. When we have completed the recharging of our energy banks, we will return to the vicinity of your planet. Whenever it becomes necessary or desirable, we will contact you again. In the meantime, the process of adapting my body to the environment of your planet will go on. But, I replied, I will not be here when you return. My work here will be finished, and I will have to return to my home in California. Incidentally, I don't even know your name, or do your people have given names? We have names, was the reply, though there is seldom any occasion to use them among ourselves. If I become a member of your race, I shall use the name Alan, which is a common name in your country and is nearly the same as my given name, which is pronounced as though it were spelled in your language Alan. As to your being in California when we return, this should make little difference in our ability to contact you. We have recorded your exact frequency pattern and, as I said, your mind receives well. In fact, if you had had a little more practice in resolving mental images, it might have been possible for us to have shown you the details of our own craft without you having to be in it. In book was here a diagram of the ship. I should like very much to learn more about your ship and how it operates, I said. If the details of your mothership are too difficult as a starter, how about trying me out on the details of the small one I am in? If I close my eyes and concentrate, won't it be possible for you to give me at least a cross-sectional view of this craft? Hardly, Alan replied, a little dryly. You are making the error which your people so often make when they attempt what they refer to as extrasensory perception. In the first place, it isn't extrasensory at all. It is just as much a part of the body's normal perception equipment as any of the others, except that during one phase of the development of a race it falls into disuse because it is a rather public form of communication, and during this phase of development, the individual requires a considerable degree of privacy in his words and thoughts. Most of your animals use the sense to a greater degree than your people, and for some of your insects, it is the only means of communication. Secondly, do not concentrate. Concentration is the attitude of transmission and is almost a complete barter reception. To receive properly, you must achieve a state of complete relaxation. This you have the ability to do, and it is an ability that is rather rare among your people. In the analysis of your mind, made before this contact was decided upon, we found that you made use of a mental relaxation device which was very interesting because of its simplicity and effectiveness. Do you know the one to which I refer?
Oh yes, I said. I use it often when sleep doesn't come readily. I simply visualize a room which is completely dark except for 10 luminous numerals on the far wall of the room. I focus my attention upon these numerals until all other thoughts have been excluded from my consciousness. I then begin, one by one, to erase the numerals, keeping my mind focused upon the remaining ones, but lowering the degree of concentration with each erasure. I usually fall asleep while there are still several numbers to go, but in no case have I ever remained conscious more than a few seconds after the last one is gone.
Exactly, Alan replied. And not only does this process relax the conscious mind, but it also returns all extraneous thoughts to their proper place in the filing cabinet of the memory banks. Under these conditions, the unconscious and the conscious portions of the mind become one under the best possible conditions for both transmission and reception. But again, we have strayed from the project at hand. I was going to suggest that you use your own method of relaxing your mind. Keep your eyes upon the area of the viewing screen, which is now dark, and when your mind is sufficiently relaxed, I will attempt to give you a mental picture of the interior of the craft in which you are riding. It was not necessary for me to visualize a darkened room. When the viewing beam was turned off, the compartment in which I was riding became totally dark. I had no difficulty in visualizing the luminous numerals on the area of the viewing screen. But when I attempted to exclude the dozens of questions that were beating an insistent tattoo upon the fringe of my consciousness, I found it practically impossible. Eventually I gave up trying to exclude them entirely, and sweeping them as far back as possible, I began to erase the numerals. So great is the force of habit that, as I mentally erased the numerals, one by one, my mind cleared, so that by the time I had reached the last one I was almost asleep. With the removal of the last numeral, I became aware of a picture upon the viewing screen, which I had not noticed before. It did not appear suddenly, it seemed as though it had always been there, but that I was seeing it for the first time. In the left-hand portion of the picture I recognized the compartment in which I was riding, and I knew that the picture must represent the interior of the entire craft. I heard a voice coming to me, but this time as from a distance. Somehow, I knew it was Alan's voice, although the timbre had changed considerably. The voice I had been hearing had been crisp and rather sharp. This one was soft and flowing, with an almost musical quality. You are seeing the parts of the ship and its mechanism which your mind is capable of grasping. The large drum-like structure just above the central bulkhead is the differential accumulator. It is essentially a storage battery that is capable of being charged from a number of natural energy sources. We can recharge it from the energy banks of our own ship, but this is seldom necessary. In your stratosphere, for example, there are several layers of ionized gas which, although they are highly rarefied, are also highly charged. By placing the ship in a planetary orbit at this level, it is able to collect, during each orbit, several times the energy required to place it in orbit. It would also, of course, collect a significant number of high-energy electrons from the Sun. By the term charging the differential accumulator, I merely mean that a potential difference is created between two poles of the accumulator. The accumulator material has available free electrons in quantities beyond anything of which you could conceive. The control mechanism allows these electrons to flow through various segments of the force rings which you see at the top and bottom of the craft. You are familiar enough with electrodynamics to know that a moving electron creates a magnetic field.
The tremendous surge of electrons through the force rings creates a very strong magnetic field. Since the direction and amplitude of the flow can be controlled through either ring, and in several paths through a single ring, we can create a field which oscillates in a pattern of very precisely controlled modes. In this way we can create magnetic resonance between the two rings or between the several segments of a single ring. As you know, any magnetic field which is changing in intensity, will create an electric field which, at any given instant, is equal in amplitude, opposite in sign and perpendicular to the magnetic field. If the two fields become mutually resonant, a vector force will be generated. Unless the amplitude and the frequency of the resonance are quite high, the vector field will be very small, and may pass unnoticed. However, the amplitude of the vector field increases at a greater rate than the two fields which generate it and, at high resonance levels, becomes very strong. The vector field, whose direction is perpendicular to each of the other two, creates an effect similar to, and in fact identical with a gravitational field. If the center of the field coincides with the craft's center of mass, the only effect will be to increase the inertia, or mass, of the craft. If the center of mass does not coincide with the center of force, the craft will tend to accelerate toward that center. Since the system which creates the fields is a part of the ship, it will, of course, move with the ship, and will continue constantly to generate a field whose center of attraction is just ahead of the ship's center of mass, so that the ship will continue to accelerate as long as the field is generated. A very simple analogy would be the small boy who harnesses his dog to his toy wagon, ties a wiener to the end of a stick, and holds the wiener in front of the dog's nose. The dog will, of course, pursue the wiener, and so pull the wagon, but because the position of the wiener is fixed with respect to the wagon, the dog will never overtake it. Note that this system does not involve free energy or what your people would call perpetual motion. In pulling the wagon, the dog is dissipating considerable energy and, while he does not overtake the wiener, he must occasionally be fed if the process is to continue. To slow or stop the craft, the controls are adjusted so the field is generated with its center just behind the center of mass, so that negative acceleration will result. You may have wondered how long you could breathe the air in the small passenger compartment before it became stuffy and vitiated. You can see here that there are small vents beneath each of the two rear seats, with a mechanism to circulate the air from the cargo hold, through the passenger compartment. There is no means, in this craft, of renewing the air, but the large volume of air in the hold would, in an emergency, supply even four passengers with adequate oxygen for several hours. The case which you see just above the differential accumulator, contains the remote control equipment. There is no particular point in going into this since you are already familiar with many types of remote control equipment and servo mechanisms. While our controls are considerably simpler and more dependable than most of yours, it would require quite a bit of reorientation in physics to give you a true understanding of their operation. Our time is running out. We have returned you at a velocity somewhat greater than that of the outward trip. And you are now almost directly above your point of departure, since your people, unlike ours, appear to derive a certain degree of pleasure, or as you would call it, a kick from experiencing wide variations of a gravitational force. We can, if you wish, create during the descent, a condition closely approaching zero gravity or what you would term free fall. To reach this condition fully under the present circumstances would be somewhat dangerous. But we can approach it closely enough so that while you will still retain some stability, you will experience the sensation of weightlessness. The sudden realization that the trip was nearly over snapped me out of the state of semi-trance in which I had been since I had first entered the craft. Okay, I said. Lead on, Macduff. I'll try anything once. Instantly the compartment light came on. After the period of total darkness, the light was blinding. While I was attempting to adjust my eyes to the light, my stomach suddenly leapt upward toward my chest. For a moment I seemed to feel my heart beating against the lower end of my throat, while my lungs and other upper organs seemed determined to extrude through my ears. I had been through steep dives and sharp pullouts in airplanes, and have ridden in many amusement devices designed to produce the feeling of weightlessness, but had never before experienced zero gravity applied instantly. There was no sensation of falling. It simply felt as though my organs, having been released from a heavy strain, were springing upward like elastic bands when released from tension. Fortunately, this sensation was of short duration,